This is an absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous book. How did this? How did you conceive of this book, Carver Country?
The conception really belongs to the photographer, Bob Adelman, and he began to take some photos of Ray in 1984 for Life magazine, and they were going to run a feature on Ray because they thought he was going to get the Pulitzer Prize. Well, as it turned out, William Kennedy got the Pulitzer Prize, so they dropped the article. Along with the photographs. And Bob had gotten to know Ray, and they'd enjoyed one another's company, and Bob proposed to him that he do a piece, maybe a book, really, called Carver Country. And Ray wrote him a letter, which they include in the text of the book, telling him what places had been important to him in his childhood and which had contributed to his work. Bob's conception was that he would pair some of the poems with these actual places and with some of the people who'd actually appeared in the stories and inspired the stories. So you'll find in the book Jerry Caravole, my blind friend, who did actually visit us at in Syracuse, and who became the main character in Cathedral. And there are many places in Yakima, places where Ray fished. There are photographs of there's a big billboard which says bankruptcy in it, which is a memento of Ray's two bankruptcies. He took a lot of photographs before Ray died, more photographs after the Life magazine photographing session. And then these photographs came to Ray about 2 weeks before he died. So he did get to see many of them and really loved them. And after Ray died, this was August 2nd, 1988, Bob contacted my agent and asked her if she would approach me about helping him finish the book. So I thought it was something that Ray had been involved in, and I'd seen the photographs and looked at them with him. And I decided it was a very worthy project, and that the photos were themselves quite wonderful.
So Bob Adelman, in effect, reconstructed a good portion of Ray's life.
Yes, the book combines attention to the life, the people who were important to Ray, and also to his fiction, and also his work.
Some of the photographs have kind of a 1930s feeling about them.
Really? I thought some of them were also 1950-ish.
A 50-ish, too, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, for example, the Bella Vista Inn.
Yes. Sort of an Art Deco front to that, isn't it?
It really does. Uh-huh. And it's strange. It's a strange feeling when you read somebody's fiction. You have mental images.
Yes.
And sometimes they're not exactly the reality, but these are very close, actually.
Yeah, I think a lot of the icons that people associated with Carver Country, which is not just a landscape, but really a lot of the interior realities of a certain segment of the country are present in the book. I'm talking about the working class and the middle class, the people who had in the 50s what we used to call the American dream, the two-car garage and sending the children to college and so on. And now these are the people in Ray's stories who don't get those things, who are living on the edge. These are people we began to pay attention to through Ray's fiction, I think, in the literature of the country. This was the first time in a long time these people have been present in their own vernacular, speaking the way they speak. And the Reagan era, pretty well tried to ignore these people. They were so-called the people who fell through the safety net, and it was their tough luck if they were out of work and didn't have insurance and so on. And these are exactly the people that Ray was interested in his work.
Let's talk about Raymond Carver for a bit. You have a very poignant introduction to this beautiful book. Ray was kind of an unlikely candidate to be the kind of author he turned out to be, wasn't he? When you think about it, his origins were rather bleak.
Well, yes, there were no books to speak of in the house. Zane Grey, I think his father read Zane Grey mysteries. But he came up pretty much the way I did, through reading in the library, and just a fascination with books, because that was exactly what was missing. We were greatly drawn to books and to the library. And he did have an influential friend named King Cook Kreiger in his high school days, who listened to jazz and had a sense of the world beyond Yakima, Washington, where Ray was growing up. And I met him on a trip to San Francisco to talk about the book. He turned up at one of the readings, and we had a wonderful visit. And he gave a portrait of Ray in those high school days and described the first couple of days of Ray coming into that school. So I saw something very essential about Ray in this story he told me. I never thought of Ray as anybody who would fight anybody, but King Kreiger said that Ray accidentally or purposely kind of bumped up against this guy named, I think his name was Roy Baker. And he was a kind of scrappy, wiry guy. And Roy Baker just was going to fight it out with him, you know, and said, "I'll meet you at the park." So the other boys thought, "Oh, well, you know, this will be over in 2 minutes." Evidently, they started to battle, and Ray would land about 2 blows to every 5 of Roy Baker's. And he would be encouraged by those 2 blows he could land. And nonetheless, he got his nose broken, and he was all bloody. And Roy Baker was just pounding away on him. But he'd land those 2 blows, and the thing kept going and going. And the boys said they swore. It must have gone on for half an hour behind trees, down in the ditches, across the bridge. And they finally realized that this new boy was not going to quit, that no matter how hard or how many times that the Roy Baker hit him, he was going to stay up and he was going to get his 2 punches in. So they decided they had to stop the fight. And they did. They took both the boys over to some parents' house in the neighborhood, and they parents made them wash up and shake hands and walk out of there. After that, everybody gave Ray a very wide berth at that high school.
Boys will be boys.
Yeah.
You write, speaking of the high school, in your introduction you write about going back to a high school class reunion. Tell me about that.
After Ray's death, the high school in Yakima that Ray attended, there was a woman there named Linda Brown, and she was making a special library collection of his books for the students to use, and she invited me to speak to the student body. And then afterwards, she said, "Would you like to visit a class?" And I said, "Sure." She said, "Well, which class would you like to go to?" And I said, "Well, Bonehead English." I said, "Cause that's where Ray would be if Ray was here." And so we went to that class, and I read some of the poems that are actually set around Yakima. And they listened, and they were, I think they were very involved in the fact that someone who'd grown up where they had and who had gotten D's in English had gone on to become one of this country's leading writers.
He certainly became one of the leading, if not the leading, short story writer of the middle 1980s, I believe. I can't tell you how many people I have interviewed at these microphones who have imitated him or tried to imitate Ray Carver's very spare style. It's very difficult to do. He packed so much into a sentence, into a line. He packed so much into a word by its very placement within a sentence.
Right. So. We've called him a precisionist. That's what he liked that term.
And in many respects, he exceeded his mentor, John Gardner, didn't he?
Well, he probably wouldn't have said that himself. He didn't like to he didn't like to compete or compare very much. He thought everybody, each person, had their own special talent, and he was very respectful about John Gardner, and certainly got some of the ways he felt about fiction from John's book on moral fiction.
Ray got off to kind of a bad start, I believe. You say here he was married at the age of 19.
Yes,
whole family, and what a burden that was for a young man.
Right. Yeah, you know, he had to sometimes go out and write on his lap in the car, just to get a little quiet. And they were both working very dull jobs. She worked for the telephone company, I believe, for a while. And these jobs, would go for a while and then run out. She sold vitamins, and that became a topic of one of Ray's stories, that his ex-wife had sold vitamins door to door. And he had done everything from pick hops to put bicycles together for Sears and run errands for a pharmacy and mopped up in the autopsy room of Mercy Hospital. And some of his poems come out of those experiences.
Her picture's in that book, isn't it?
Yes, uh-huh.
How did you meet Ray?
Well, we met in Dallas in 1977. It was a writer's conference at SMU, and I was the only woman there. So I was had a full scope of all these nice men. They all were married, I think. Ray was no exception. So we were just friends, and I just said, oh, I just like your fiction so much. I hadn't heard him read his fiction before, and I hadn't really read very much of it. I just heard his reputation. And it turned out that we were the only ones who weren't out carousing at night, so we would meet up at breakfast time and have breakfast together, he and Richard Ford and myself. Richard Ford was meeting Ray for the first time and would then become his best friend.
Ray had a long battle with alcoholism. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. At that time I met him in Dallas, he'd been sober about 5 months, and he didn't write at all during the last 2 years of his alcoholism. It was a 10-year downward slide, and in the last year of it, he was hospitalized a couple of times and also went to Duffy's and then got out, fell off the wagon, and had to try again to get sober. He dates his sobriety from June 2nd, 1977. We always used to celebrate that day. By the time I met him the second time, he was no longer in his marriage, and I was at another writer's conference, and he was coming to El Paso to teach there at the university. And by then, he'd had a year and a half of sobriety, so he was a good bit steadier at that point. Nonetheless, we met, and then I went away, give him a little more time, and we began to write to each other and call each other. And by January of 1979, we had decided to live together, and I flew back with him to El Paso. And he still had a lot of things that he had to be careful about. You saw him really carefully establishing his daily rhythms, and we would always leave company by 10 o'clock at night so he wouldn't get too tired, since that's one of the AA recommendations, is that you not get over, extend your energies too far. And he could be around drinking. We kept alcohol in the house for guests who wanted to drink, and I had an occasional drink, which he even enjoyed. He enjoyed for me to have a drink sometimes if we were in company. But he luckily wasn't that kind of drinker who, once he stops, is really frightened by having liquor around and is ready to sort of plunge off into it any moment. He really had been fully delivered from it, it seemed.
So during, you had a relationship for about 11 years.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And during this period, he remained sober.
Yes, he did.
It's very strange, isn't it? I usually have one, two, sometimes three drinks after I get off of work, and then I stop.
Mm-hmm. Ray couldn't stop.
Yeah, isn't that strange that you can enjoy alcohol and not let it consume you? I mean, most people that I know, in fact, almost everybody I know, with rare exceptions, drinks.
Huh.
But they don't let it take over their lives. But apparently an alcoholic can't stop it.
Yeah, well, at a certain point, it really turns on you. The booze turns on you. I mean, you think you can handle it, and then the first thing you know, even one drink makes you drunk, and you're not under control. And in fact, Ray would just drink to oblivion, and then he would pass out, and he wouldn't remember things. He had blackouts. He would do quite disastrous things, some of which I have been hearing about. You see, this is not a part of my knowledge of Ray, so it's been curious, part of the aftermath of his death, to be with people who knew him during that earlier part of his life, and who saw some of these raw times, what Ray used to call his bad Raymond days. My father was alcoholic, so I did see it wasn't, you know, new to me, that kind of behavior, and so was my second husband. So I was glad to finally be in love with somebody who wasn't going in that direction.
Well, he was candid, and as you will hear in the interviews that I had with him, he was candid about the problems, and he had run-ins with the police and days. He didn't know where he was.
Right.
In strange places.
Right.
But that is also, I guess, part of coming to grips with the disease, to be able to say, this is what happened to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it varies, you know. Some alcoholics never really do get able to talk about it in a very open way. But Ray felt that it was valuable to others, you know, that he not maintain, you know, his anonymity, and that his example could help people. And in fact, we did in the book include a very lovely letter that he wrote to a man named Mr. Hallstrom. And this was a young writer who'd had writer's block after he stopped drinking. And he'd written to Ray and said, did you have this, and what do you do about it? And Ray had just said, it'll be quite a period probably before you write again, because being sober really takes a lot of energy, and you should just be happy that you're heading into this sobriety and not worry about the writing. Give it some time. Do some other things in your life. So we've printed the whole text of that letter that Mr. Hallstrom so kindly passed along to me after Ray's death.
In your introduction, you have a wonderful anecdote, the story of Ray and the Mercedes. Yeah. Dallas, can you tell us about that?
Oh, well, that wasn't in Dallas, actually. That was in Syracuse. You know, we lived in Syracuse for 10 years. We had this split existence where from 1983 on, well, we taught full-time, both of us there, from 80 to 83. And then 83, began to live part-time in Port Angeles and part-time in Syracuse and teach only one semester there. I was the only one teaching. Then Ray stayed there doing his teaching while I was out west in Port Angeles nursing my father. And we had been working on a film script. It was a rewrite for Michael Cimino, and Carlo Ponti was the producer on The Life of Dostoevsky. We got a good hunk of money, and Ray wanted to make sure that it didn't just evaporate. So he'd had these horrible cars, and it would always break down. So he went down to the Mercedes dealership, just in this old V-neck sweater with the elbows worn out, and said he'd like to take a 1983 Mercedes for a spin. And the salesman really looked very askance at him, you know. And Ray didn't really understand why until he looked down and noticed that he'd worn his bedroom slippers down there. And nonetheless, they got in the car, and this very stony-faced guy let Ray drive out past these rib takeout places and out into the countryside and turn around and come back. And Ray said, oh, this is very nice. I like it. You know, I'd like to have this car. And the man sort of brightened a little bit, but still said, well, and how, you know, when would you be wanting it, sir? And Ray said, well, is tomorrow too soon? And the guy said, oh, well, we could probably arrange that. How would you be paying for this, sir? And Ray said, is cash okay? And the guy said, oh, that will be just fine. And so they made the arrangements then for getting the car to Ray, and he drove it across the country out to Port Angeles, and we christened it the Mercedes that Dostoevsky bought after he reached it.
There is one of his poems. I guess it's a poem. It's kind of hard to describe it about that. I can't remember what
it's kind of a litany.
Yeah. Devoted to all of the clunky cars.
Yeah, it's called The Car. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking at a poem he writes about bankruptcy, and there's a photograph showing a person in a billboard, the billboard titled Bankruptcy, Consumer Credit Counseling, and a telephone number. You write in the introduction to this book, I think you said your first big fight was over a credit card that followed, that Ray lost, I guess, his credit cards after his bankruptcy. Can you tell me about
that? Well, yeah, they essentially said to him, you know, what Cupertino, a police car, he said, pulled up in front of the house, you know, and they got a megaphone, and they just shouted, throw out your credit cards and come out with your hands up. But yeah, we had a fight over, you know, Ray wanting to take my visa and go to New Jersey. He thought he might really need to, you know, have some cash. And, So he said, you know, I could just tell him that there's a misprint on the card, that it should read Ted instead of Tess. I thought, oh yeah, fat chance, you know. But he really, you know, tried to pull things like that. And it was a hangover from those days when he learned how to sidestep things and go around any kinds of financial troubles, and he was often in those kinds of troubles. When he was first with me, he wouldn't answer the telephone for about the first 6 months, just afraid that it would be some bill collector calling. And there was also the story about his mother, about he was supposed to go to this conference, and inclination to go faded as the date approached, and he called up his host and said, you know, my mother has had a stroke and there's just no way that I can come to that conference. I've got to stay by the phone. And the next thing he did was to hang up and say to me, well, what are the symptoms for a stroke? You know, they're going to call back and ask me how she's doing, he said. And I just haven't any idea what happens to you when you have a stroke. So I had to go to this conference and, you know, just give health reports on Ray's mother, and she was meanwhile just doing grand in Sacramento. But he would do that. He would get himself into things and then sort of lie his way out sometimes. That was kind of a hangover from those old drinking days.
Well, I think, didn't you just mention that this big award that he won? Who was it?
Mildred and Harold Strauss Living Award.
That was really kind of an economic turnaround there.
Yeah, 1983, and then he stopped teaching, and I only taught half time. But that was a wonder, you know, and it must look like a very wonderful thing to those people who are administering that too now, because those years really allowed him to write those wonderful last stories and to complete those three books of poetry.
He became ill in 1987, didn't he?
Yes, in the fall, tumor in the lung. He'd been smoking since he was 19, and he was smoking now cigarettes, smoked them pretty heavy. It's very hard, I think, for the alcoholics to give up those other sustaining habits, you know. But Cheever had given up both, and I remember meeting Cheever's wife at Yaddo and her saying to Ray, well, it's about time. How long has it been since you gave up your drinking? And he said 6 years. She said, well, it's about time you gave up the cigarettes. But he just wasn't able to. He actually considered it a part of an extension of his writing, and I remember him putting out the cigarette just before we were going in for the operation, which they took out two-thirds of the lung, and he said, well, I'm just not sorry I smoked all those cigarettes because I got all those great stories. But that wasn't, I must say, his attitude at the very end when we were in the hospital in Seattle. He told me we had some little cigarillos, and he would smoke sort of one every now and again. He had stopped smoking, you know, cigarettes, but every now and again he'd have one of these little cigarillos. He said, take those. He said, and throw them as far as you can throw them. So he was just really angry then that this had cost him his life.
Yeah, it's a terrible, terrible addiction, in many respects worse than alcohol. And I was a heavy cigarette smoker for a couple of years, and I know how hard it was to stop. I tried everything. I tried the little cigarillos. I tried pipes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I tried gum, candy. I tried to phase it out.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be almost impossible. The first thing I would do, and I'm sure Ray did the same thing, first thing I would grab in the morning next to my glasses would be my cigarettes.
Cigarettes, yeah.
Last thing to go out would be the cigarettes.
Yeah, exactly.
I just couldn't stop.
But I think it's hard to imagine what it, you know, the ramifications of it. I mean, who thinks when they're smoking a cigarette that they could get a brain tumor? I mean, and that's eventually the next step, you see, after it goes to the lung. The most frequent site then for the traveling of that particular cancer is to the brain. So then he had this brain tumor.
Well, that was in 1987.
That happened, that began, we knew about it, in March of 88.
March of 88. Because I did interview him in 1988.
We didn't let anybody know about it.
He was alert and well. Uh-huh. And he seemed healthy, but I couldn't tell.
Well, it depends on when you interviewed him. You'd have to look back. But he, I think a few people did know about the brain tumor. He did receive radiation, and they did have hope that this would give him some years. But it's usually a sign of that the cancer has metastasized. So it had traveled. It was a large cell cancer, which travels in the bloodstream. They can't really identify it very easily. But by May, it had entered the other lung, and there were tumors in the other lung. And at that point, we really didn't tell anybody because we wanted to work at finishing that last wonderful book of his. And we knew already from the experience with the lung operation that if we told people, we would spend all of our time consoling our friends and also entering into it in a very downward way. And so we tried to do things to encourage our own spirits, since we were the ones most concerned in the matter. And I got married. Ray and I got married, and that was a celebration of our 11-year relationship. We went to Reno and went gambling, and I had a big winning streak on the roulette.
Well, I was Sheikh and I had admired Ray's work for so many years, and having actually met him and talked to him, just as I'm talking to you about the work and about his background, when I read the obituary in the Times, I woke up one morning, I was shaken and very sad. And
it's too early, very much too early.
Really, he was 49, wasn't he?
He was 50.
I immediately grabbed the interviews I'd done with him and excerpted them so that I could do something on the air, kind of tribute to Ray, which I did, I believe, the following week. But the book itself, The Carver Country, is also a tribute to Ray, isn't it?
Yes. I very much got drawn into the project, even though I came on the scene rather late. I mean, in that it was, I would say it was about half completed at the time I came into it.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and Ray Carver's many, many fans are, when they find out about it, are going to love this book. It's just gorgeous, and in a way, it's another extension of Ray's life, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. Very important record, I think.
Ms. Gallagher, thank you very much.
Thank you.